We're now joined by Amanda DuBarry, the CEO at Caritas Anchor House, our next door neighbours at 105 Barking Road. We've worked with Anchor House before as Community Links, I mean, and obviously we sit on quite a few meetings and initiatives as well. Amanda, over to you to give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself and also about what your organisation does.
Well, thank you for having me, Chi. As I say, I'm Amanda DuBarry. I'm the Chief Exec for Caritas Anchor House. So Caritas Anchor House has been operating in the borough for nearly 60 years, initially as a Seamen's Mission and then as a homelessness service since the 1990s. I took over as CEO in 2018. We have 140 beds here at 81 Barking Road, and we've recently opened a number of additional services in partnership with CGL and the council to provide services for rough sleepers. So we now have multiple locations, but all in Newham. So we're very much a Newham community-focused organisation working at the front line, really, of homelessness in the borough.
Fantastic. Thank you for the introduction, a little bit about yourself and your organisation there. And might I say a much needed service, of course. And I can imagine that demands for what you do is actually increased over the pandemic. But that's an assumption on my side. I mean, yeah. what is your experience? Have things got worse? What's changed?
So on the rough sleeper side, definitely demand has increased. We have, in the last maybe 3 years, started doing a lot more with rough sleepers. So before I arrived, although we would occasionally take people that had those kind of lower or medium level support needs who had been rough sleeping, most of our residents weren't rough sleepers. So we weren't really contributing, I felt, to the rough sleeper needs in the borough, which anyone who's been around in Newham for a few years will know that, you know, they really kind of peaked a few years ago and were really quite worrying levels. And you would see Newham being reported on the national news as having very high levels of rough sleepers, and of course a lot of those in the Stratford Centre. So we started working with the council back in December 2018, opening an assessment hub for rough sleepers, and since then we've increased the number of people who have been rough sleeping that we have brought into Anchor House. And since then, quite recently in September, we started working in partnership with CGL, delivering a number of services across the borough. So we've definitely seen an increased need since then. Obviously, in the first lockdown, when people were unable to move, we had a number of people who were in the building who had to stay here much longer than they needed to stay here, potentially. So everyone was kind of locked down, and the only people moving were moving in a kind of emergency crisis type situation. It's been a busy old time, and demand increases continuously. And the demand that we've seen really increasing has been those complex needs residents and residents who have got no recourse to public funds. So they're effectively destitute very, very difficult group to support, because obviously there's the complex immigration need, but there's, you know, they just have no access to food, toiletries, clothing, anything. So really kind of working with absolute crisis poverty situations. Quite shocking, really.
It sounds it. That's the second time I've heard you talk about your organisation and sort of the need, particularly amongst those folks with no recourse to public funds. But every time I hear it, I'm just struck by that. I mean, in terms of the advice that you might be able to give someone with no recourse to public funds, I mean, the legal advice, it's clearly hard to come by, I'd imagine. Or do you work with other agencies like pro bono law firms? How does that work?
Yeah, we're really lucky. There's Praxis have got a contract to operate in the borough and to provide immigration services for the rough sleepers. So we work closely with Praxis. We also work closely with the Renewal Programme and New Day, who have got some funding from Homeless Link around that as well. So we are lucky that there are some services, but I think Newham has probably got the highest number of rough sleepers who are highest proportion who are no recourse to public funds in London as well. So it's a huge, huge issue. And it's very difficult because people come into services, they've got no way of paying any rent, they've got no way of moving on until their status is sorted. You know, we're past that cut-off point around EU applications. So, you know, we have no idea at this stage how long those waiting applications are going to take. And anyone outside of the EU, I mean, we just don't know if they're ever going to get their immigration status resolved. So in the meantime, you know, people literally don't have any money to buy washing powder to wash clothes or to eat on a day-to-day basis. So it's a real kind of humanitarian crisis type effort that goes on trying to support that group.
Gosh, it sounds like a challenging thing to be engaged with. It really does. Do you have any insight into people's sort of family backgrounds before they come to you in terms of family breakdown? What's the sort of catalyst, effectively, that would lead someone to end up with yourselves?
Yeah, I mean, the single cause that sits behind all homelessness, as far as I've experienced in the last 27 years I've been working in homelessness, is trauma. So, it can be family breakdown for younger people with parents. It can be relationship breakdown quite often for single men. It's relationship breakdown and the inability to afford to support, you know, two homes for them to live separately from their wife and children. It can be job loss, which is often rooted in kind of mental health crises that people have prior to that. So, you know, it's lots of things, but, you know, fundamentally it comes down to trauma and people being unwell and struggling to cope.
Gosh, and I'm drawing a very, I'm generalizing here, but a lot of what you just said makes me think that actually a lot of the trauma, it comes from situations where someone could be living their 9-to-5 everyday life. A normal life, for want of a better phrase, but then all of a sudden something could happen, and that trauma can manifest itself in so many different ways. You've spoken about relationship breakdown, job breakdown, mental health challenges, but everything up until that point could have been sort of okay or normal, so to speak. And that trauma, you know.
So we have residents at either end of the spectrum, really. So we have some residents who, you know, they have so many adverse childhood experiences and so much trauma from their entire life. You know, they've been in the care system, they've been abandoned by parents, they may have been abused when they were younger, and they've just got into this whole awful life based on, you know, really not having a chance in life and having been mistreated, and, you know, they've missed out on school, they haven't had a settled home and so on and so forth, and they've kind of lapsed into homelessness and prison and all of those kind of things. But at the other end of the scale, we also have people who have been in great jobs. You know, I had a lady here a year or so ago, I remember, who had been nursing all of her life and then had back problems, and she had, you know, a lot of pain, and eventually she had to give up working, and she just couldn't afford to keep her flat. She didn't have, you know, she didn't have a partner or other family. And so she became homeless, you know, having worked her entire life for the NHS, because she just didn't have enough income. We had another chap a year or so ago who shared his story with me, and he'd been working in banking, I think, and quite you know, successful kind of middle class type and his father died, and it, you know, sent him into depression, the shock of his father dying, and they stopped going into work, and then eventually he got sacked. And eventually couldn't pay his rent, and eventually, you know, lost his flat and ended up on the street, and actually didn't tell a soul because he was so ashamed and so embarrassed of, you know, where he'd come from and where he'd ended up, that he didn't tell anybody. And it was only through his church, I think, that, you know, he got referred across to us in the end, which was great. But yeah, I mean, we kind of work with everyone on either end of the spectrum and everyone in between, really. And as you say, I mean, it can happen to anyone. You know, it's really quite shocking that so many people in our borough are having these experiences, you know, week in, week out.
Thank the Lord you do what you do, to be honest with you, because it's just hearing about those examples. If your organization wasn't there, I'd hate to think what the next alternative is. It's you get lots of agencies doing advice, and some of them you mentioned now in this conversation do some really good work. But, you know, to be able to receive advice, act on the advice, and, you know, better your lot for the future, you need a roof over your head. You know, you can't be giving someone advice if they're out on the streets or homeless or rough sleeping. It can't be, that can't be easy. It's not a, gosh.
And it's an imperfect system. I mean, I know, you know, here in Anchor House, we've got 140 residents. That's quite an intense place to live, and it doesn't work for everyone, and because we are trying to help people with a whole range of needs, you know, I'm aware that there are times when there's you know, some difficult behavior in the building which is frightening to some of the residents, and there's always that balance of trying to, you know, make this a safe place, but also to make it a welcoming, open place which is actually meeting the needs of the people who are experiencing homelessness in the borough. But at the end of the day, as you say, you know, the alternative is that people are on the streets. So I'm very glad that we have this service here. But I do recognise that, you know, it can't be all things to all people, and you know, there is more that's needed.
Gosh, I've been reminded in this conversation that actually your emphasis on impact is so important, and that, you know, you don't fall into that trap where someone can end up staying with you for an indefinite amount of time. You are focused. As soon as someone arrives with you, you are focused on helping them to get on their feet and get something more sustainable. And I think the trap is very much you become that open-ended, oh, come here, we'll put a roof over your head.
Yeah, I think that's one of the downfalls of some hostel services, is that they just become permanent homes for people, and that's not what we're here to do. We're very much about providing a transition for people, so helping people to get from where they are to where they want to be, and seeing that as a short-term focused period of change, not a permanent place to stay. So, you know, we work with people really to help them to find their new homes, rather than, you know, this is their home whilst they're here, but it's not their home forever. So we have a move on team, which has been growing. We've been, you know, fundraising like crazy to get some extra money in so that we can grow that team, so that we can help more people to move on, because there's very much that typical bell curve, you know, that you get in working with people. So, you know, to start with, you engage with people and they progress and you have a good impact. But eventually you get to a point where you don't make any more progress, and typically that's when people start to become institutionalized and they lose motivation and they go downhill. And it doesn't matter how hard you try and work with people, there's just a kind of finite limit to how much you can achieve in, you know, these kind of temporary conditions. So we're very minded that if we're going to have the best impact for people and free up bed spaces so that more people can come in from the streets, then, you know, we need to be really effective at moving people on at the time when they're ready to move on. So we have a brilliant move on team, and they're dedicated to helping people to find their future homes when they're ready.
I admire that, because it's just the biggest trap, I think. You know, I know from Community Links, I know that some of our services have been a bit more developed in terms of our thinking and our theory of change. And in those situations, you know, you are able to sort of recognize as a bell curve, recognize it's about helping people to move on and investing in the right places. But then I'll pick on the food bank again, which is a service where we started to do because we saw the need in the community. Perhaps we didn't think it through, because I look at the rate of people coming back time and time again to use the food bank, and I just think to myself, oh, if only we'd spent a little bit more time on service design, we would have had built in from the start a model whereby we recognize that people come to use us, we help them to get them back on their feet, but actually the real focus has got to be on helping someone in the long term rather than that trap of just the short-term help.
We try to model our rents with the same kind of thinking in mind. It's always a real challenge in supported housing. The rents have to be quite high in order to cover, you know, all of the sort of intent management costs that you have in projects like this. But what that means is it's not very affordable for residents to then go and get jobs. So what we've done is we've come up with a good old gentleman's compromise, I suppose, where we subsidise people's rent for the first 3 months that they're working. But the intent behind that is in that 3 months, we will help them to find somewhere to move on to, so that, you know, at the end of that 3 months, when we stop subsidising, they'll be living somewhere else which is more affordable. And that gives them a period of time to kind of settle into their job and get used to paying rent, and then to move on. So, you know, we're trying to use, as you say, that kind of impact in mind thinking all the time behind what we're doing. It's incredibly difficult in these type of services because, you know, they're designed almost you know, across the country with one thing in mind, and the system doesn't work with all of those kind of more rounded needs in mind.
Of course, but what you do is just very much aligned with the whole early action approach. You know, perhaps the latter part of that, which is preventing a situation from getting worse.
Yes.
You know, so that when someone does move on, you know, it's about making sure that they don't have to ever come back.
As much as
the home in the short term, you want them to then progress and move on and be independent.
And we have a very, very high success rate when people move on. So it's very rarely that people's move on tenancies don't work out for them. So I think last year it was 100% of the tenancies succeeded and were sustained, which is brilliant, you know, because that's what we're here to do. We're here to help people to, you know, find their new home, find their future and their independence, and, you know, go off and live happily ever after.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. In terms of the sort of outlook for the borough so far, you mentioned that you'd had an opportunity to look into the draft strategy, but that was some time ago. I mean, first of all, I'm delighted you looked into it at an early stage rather than being asked to consult a month or whatever or two before it came out. But, you know, just taking your general sort of feel from the strategy and also just from what you do on a day-to-day basis as the CEO, what's the outlook for you? Do you feel things are going to be quite positive with the different agencies working on the same page, or what's your sort of gut instinct?
Yeah, I mean, I think Newham have come a long way in the last few years. So, you know, I was quite shocked when I came to work in Newham back in 2018 at how little there was in place, how poorly joined up everything was. So Caritas Ankerhouse and the CEO of the renewal programme at the time started up the Homelessness Forum in Newham, which, you know, didn't exist, which, you know, in every other borough that I'd worked in, you know, the Homelessness Forum was quite an established platform, and, you know, it didn't exist in this borough. There was really no rough sleeping provision other than the New Day night shelter, which was obviously a voluntary effort. So it feels like it's come an enormous way since 2018, which is wonderful. And, you know, a lot of that's been supported by central government funds around rough sleeping initiative and so on. So yeah, it definitely feels like it's moving in the right direction. And there's nothing in the Newham homelessness strategy really that I would disagree with. I think the trick is around, you know, what's going to be operationalised and when it's going to be operationalised and how it's going to be operationalised. So I think all the principles in that strategy are pretty sound. You know, great to see that there's some more plans around homelessness prevention, more plans around rough sleeping. Hopefully, you know, both of our agencies will be part of delivering some of this stuff going forward. But yeah, I think the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it? And for me, it's things like how many additional social housing tenancies are going to be made available for this group. You know, that to me is, you know, we're waiting to see what's going to happen on that front.
Of course. But so positive signs. And I think, you know, Paul Cooper, who I believe is the head of homelessness prevention and advice, he was the first sort of person we interviewed as well. And he was just, yeah, massively optimistic, actually. And to be honest with you, I was I was encouraged by what he said about the strategy and the plans. And so, but you know, you're right. I guess we'll have to see what happens, of course. And I do hope we can continue to play a role and work together on, you know, improving things for the community. Just as an aside, one thing we're looking at is around this immigration advice and no recourse to public funds as well. You know, we've got a new law firm we want to work with us who are looking to part fund a solicitor.
Okay.
And we have a bit of a workshop early January, which I will invite you to, if that's okay. Just around what areas of advice they might be able to support us with, because it's very much a blank sheet of paper. And I know just from my sort of day-to-day and from conversations with yourself that there is a gap around immigration, asylum, no recourse to public funds. There's a gap on that. No law firms really want to touch that because it's casework. It's end-to-end advice, not casework. And you might be helping someone for years and years and years. But we really have an opportunity now. So fingers crossed we'll be able to make something work.
That would be fantastic. I mean, from my perspective, nationally, this is not just Newham. I mean, we can't end rough sleeping, which is, you know, one of the government pledges, isn't it? We can't do that without dealing with the no recourse to public funds issue. And there is a sort of cross-purposes thinking in the government, insofar as on one side there's this hostile, you know, approach to immigration, and on the other side there's this, you know, pledge to end rough sleeping, and the two have to come together. There has to be some systemic change there. But in the meantime, you know, there's a big group of people, and it's absolutely enormous in Newham, who are struggling under this no recourse banner, and you know, they are absolutely destitute. And I do think it's shocking that, you know, this group are being left as they are. And I'm really pleased from the homelessness perspective that the council are continuing to support that group. But it really limits their options and our options as a service provider, because obviously we can't claim housing benefits. So, you know, the properties that they're in, support that they're getting is a restricted, and it's a limited offer. And of course they're tying up beds, because we don't want to move people out and back onto the streets, but we don't have any kind of pathway onwards for them at the moment. So the pathway out of no recourse is being in a position to hold down a job, and there's quite a lead in to that, you know, in terms of English being a second language, and you know, so for some people the kind of well-being side of things, they might not physically be well enough to work. So it's, you know, it's really, really challenging for Newham in terms of the numbers of rough sleepers that are being supported but have no recourse.
I'd imagine it's like a cliff edge in reverse, if you like. It's, you're going up the cliff edge, and that to go from a position where you don't have a roof over your head and you have no recourse to public funds to then somehow being in a job, it's a huge jump, isn't it? It's a huge leap. Whereas you can be homeless or rough sleeping and eventually end up on a job. But if you do have recourse to public funds, it's a bit of a gradual, don't get me wrong, it's still uphill, but it's a bit of a gradual jump, if you like, because the society is there to support you, albeit the support's never enough. But it's uphill, but it's not a cliff edge, if you like. Whereas, that would be daunting, I imagine. I can't even imagine it, actually.
I can't imagine how people must feel when they're in that situation. It must be absolutely terrifying.
Gosh. What's it like in your experience as an organisation, helping families? I know you don't specifically help families, do you? You help individuals. Yes. But I'm grossly generalising here, and perhaps let me know if I'm stretching it too far to sort of fit with the sort of topic as far as children and homelessness. But I'm assuming that people, they do have families. Everyone came from a family, you know. And to what extent do you engage with families, or do people bring baggage of, you know, familial life, or you know, to what extent is it there? Is it a factor?
Quite a number of the men that we have here have got children. They might be estranged from their children, or they might be in contact with their children. And that's certainly, a difficult issue for them, because firstly, at the moment, you know, since COVID hit, we've had a visitors ban here, so people haven't been having visitors in. But in normal times, we have some kind of allowance for visitors. But really, this is not the most suitable place to bring children in terms of, you know, us safeguarding children, because we can never guarantee residents' behaviour. So, you know, that's been challenging. We've been looking at opening up a sort of family room or something like that on site. But, you know, you hear really awful stories about people who are fathers who are looking after their children and they've got nothing to do with them. So they just kind of ride the bus all day because they've got nowhere to go. So that's their contact with their children is just during, you know, kind of bus rides and so on. So I think, you know, there's that kind of wider need for this group who, you know, it's not just about, well, they need a roof over their head and they need some food. There's also all those wider needs. And, you know, we often find that people are reliant on family to help them by doing their washing or to help them by storing furniture. Because, of course, if people were in a flat and then they lose their flat, you know, usually they've got double beds and sofas and all of these things which they can't obviously move into a hostel type accommodation like Anchor House. So either they give it all away and lose it, or they're reliant on family storing it. So even though they might be have a sort of fractious relationship with their family, some of them have got great relationships, but even those who might have a bit of a challenging relationship, sometimes they are still reliant on that family support, you know, even just to help with furniture storage. So it's kind of a wide range of how we interact with families. We see our primary relationship as being with the resident, but there are times when residents say, oh, you know, I'd like you to speak to my mum about this. We have quite a lot of young people here, probably any one time we've got about 30 under 25s in the building. And sometimes, you know, they want us to deal with their parents about things. So, you know, we do have some contact, and obviously we do get phone calls from concerned relatives, but generally we work, you know, with the resident and the family is something, you know, that they're dealing with. But, you know, we're very aware that this building is not best set up for family visits and family interaction.
But even in this day and age, someone who's under the age of 25 is not necessarily mature in terms of life experiences. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I imagine by the time, you know, someone's a service user in your organization, they've seen things and done things that people at a much older age would never have experienced. So there's a level of maturity there. But to imagine that, you know, service users of yours would be that age and also still have their parents or, you know, guardians phoning in to sort of, I can't fathom. I find that almost quite hard to believe, but clearly there's a quite a large cohort. If 30 out of 140, did you say?
Yeah.
That's quite a large cohort of young.
Yeah. So there is no specialist young people's accommodation in Newham, which really shocked me. So when I came here, I'd spent 22 years working in youth homelessness before I came here. So I was really shocked to find that, you know, a borough with a homelessness problem the size of Newham's didn't have any kind of youth homelessness provision. And it still doesn't. So again, you know, when we're sort of looking at the strategy and thinking about what needs might flow from that, I mean, I would really like to see some youth homelessness provision in the borough, because you know, in a building as big as Anchor House, you will get, you know, we have quite a lot of women here, we have quite a lot of young people here, we have quite a lot of older people here and so on. But I do think that young people, they don't need to be mixing with that older adult group, and you know, it would be a more positive environment for them if they were in a specialist youth homelessness service instead,
and vice versa perhaps as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Older cohort not wanting or benefiting from mixing with the younger groups. Gosh, yeah. I didn't think about that. Actually, it's a bit of a blind spot for me, because I think we did touch on this in the interview this morning with Paul, but I wasn't able to really push on it. But I know in the draft strategy, children aren't really mentioned. Sort of an assumption that children will either already be in specialised housing dealt with by another agency within the council, or they'll just be subject to the same issues that their parents are, you know, at risk of homelessness, moving to council house or temporary accommodation. And but actually, yeah, I didn't think about that, but you're right. If there isn't any Gosh, that
I
is.
think also, I mean, we have to think about those children. You know, I was talking about homelessness being rooted in trauma, and adverse childhood experiences being, you know, a significant trauma for a lot of our residents. And, you know, I genuinely think that if you've got children who are in homeless families, who are experiencing homelessness and instability and perhaps inappropriate temporary accommodation and things like that at a young age, you know, that is an adverse childhood experience, you know, and so that's the next generation. You know, these are not just invisible people that we should say, oh, well, you know, we're looking after the adult and we're housing the adult and the adult brings those children with them. I think we do have to recognise that those children are experiencing trauma through the process of becoming homeless and being, you know, in temporary housing and so on. And we have to expect that those cycles start to get, you know, replayed in the future when they're older.
Gosh, scary, but encouraging we're having this conversation. I know it's just a conversation, like you said, you know, what happens is a different thing altogether, but is it, I guess you've covered this already to some extent, but is there anything else you would like to say about your sort of, you know, your magic wand as far as children in particular, or just actually homelessness in general, actually, if you could be the boss of everything, what would you do?
So many things, Chi. One of the things that I'm really strongly advocating at the moment for is about having a gender-informed approach to homelessness. I think women are a minority in homelessness services, and particularly in rough sleeper services, and they're often invisible. You know, you don't see many women on the streets, and that's because women are too blooming scared to be visible on the street. So when they are rough sleeping, you know, they're usually hiding. So they're in, you know, hidden away places where you don't get footfall from the general public, or they're avoiding rough sleeping altogether by, you know, sleeping in different people that they know's houses and so on. And often that is a high risk thing in itself, and that's leading to abuse and exploitation. There we go again around the kind of trauma loop around that. So I've been really working passionately around having a kind of gender-informed approach to homelessness, and Anchor House is lagging behind a bit. So we do have one women's service now, specialist women's service, but we are going to be looking over this year ahead at how we can have a better approach to women in this service, so that we can create kind of safe spaces within Anchor House, whether that's physical safe spaces or kind of emotional safe spaces like women's groups and women's activities and these kind of things, because I think women do feel additionally vulnerable in you know, mixed gender services, and they need a different response, and often women have come to these services through a very traumatic time, you know, whether it's domestic violence, children being removed, subsequent, you know, drug addiction. Often there's an awful lot of violence that sits behind the lives of the women that come to us, and so there's an awful lot of support and therapy and work that needs to happen with women to, you know, help them to stabilize and then start to progress after that. So definitely a kind of different trauma-informed, gender-informed approach to women in homelessness is one of my kind of magic wishes. I think I would like to see some specialist accommodation for young people in the borough, because I think it's really important that they also have safe spaces that are designed for their needs and services designed for their needs.
By young people, you mean 25 and below?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we really do need to see more access to accommodation. So At the moment, we don't get many nominations into social housing in the borough. There's talk that that could actually reduce rather than increase, which is, you know, quite appalling from my perspective, because, you know, ultimately the route out of homelessness is housing. And yes, of course, you need to have the support services around that. But even though I've been running hostels for years and years, I do passionately believe that hostels aren't the way forward. You know, hostels are a temporary measure. And really, you need to be giving people a key to a door that they can call their own and that they can stabilise and live in long term. And that's the only way that we can get people out of homelessness. And of course, you know, you can't necessarily just give everyone a key to a door. You know, some people need a kind of process of support alongside that or before that and so on. But ultimately, the key to the door has to come at some point.
As leaders, we have to think and be passionate about designing ourselves out of this system we're in. You know, not perpetuating ourselves, but designing ourselves out. And that's what you've just said there, isn't it? You know, actually, in your sort of magic wand, with your magic wand, there wouldn't be a service like yours. Equally.
These services, that would be fantastic. You know, if the system... if there was systemic change and people didn't have to hit crisis point across multiple factors that end up presenting to homelessness services, whether it's the council, whether it's voluntary services like mine, you know, that would just be wonderful, wouldn't it? If people could just get the help that they needed and not have to hit crisis point. I mean, you know, that's the aim. That's what we want.
Well, so that's powerful stuff. Rest assured, I feel the same about community links and about designing ourselves out of the need for community links, because actually, you know, that just manifests itself and, you know, within schools or within colleges that exist or churches or community spaces, there'll be no need for one organization to be delivering all these services. So
you know, it doesn't end, does it, with giving people a key to the door. There's a rough sleeper that I talk to often who he wasn't a service user of our service, but I got chatting to him on the streets, and eventually he was rehoused, which was brilliant, and he's got his own flat. But he still begs often to cover his electricity bills, and he's stuck in that fuel poverty cycle. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, you know, I put in £10 and I get about £3 worth of fuel because everything else is charges. So by the time done one load of washing up and have the heating on for half an hour, my, you know, thing goes off again. And you just think that is so wrong, isn't it? That this guy is begging on the street to pay for some electricity so he can do some washing up in you know, this lovely flat that he's been given. You know, all this stuff is kind of systemic and it needs a big overhaul, in my opinion, so that people are lifted out of poverty and they're enabled to move on and do the things that they need to do to get their life in order. And you know, I just feel this guy is now, he's no longer on the streets and tied to the streets, but he's kind of tied into begging because he's not well, he's not fit and able to work, and his background is like labouring and stuff, and he's not physically able to do that. You know, he's stuck in this really difficult position where he doesn't get enough income in order to have lighting and be able to have a hot shower and do some washing up and so on. So there he is sitting begging as if he was still rough sleeping.
That is heartbreaking. That really is. Gosh. That's heartbreaking. Really is heartbreaking. Amanda, I'm just conscious of time. It's always a pleasure to catch up. It really is.